Before businesses started opening up and people started going back to work, a lot of people noticed the changes. So much less traffic, for one, and for another, how much cleaner the air seemed. It was more than a perception. There were measurable drops in pollutants, including of greenhouse gases that contribute to global warming. The Global Carbon Project at Stanford University tracked the changes and published recent research on the drop in CO2 emissions, and simultaneously published a general interest article in Scientific American about the potential for permanent changes in transportation. Rob Jackson is a professor of Earth System Science at Stanford University and the leader of the Global Carbon Project and our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Dr. Jackson, thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me, Jeff.
Tell us, if you would, about the usual work of the Global Carbon Project.
Well, we are a group of hundreds of scientists around the world who track emissions of carbon dioxide, nitrous oxide, and methane, among other things. We look not just at industrial activity, but at agriculture and natural systems too, land, forestry activities and cropping and natural systems, and the oceans too. So we try and put all those pieces together and understand whether emissions are going up and to understand what we see in the atmosphere based on what's happening through human activities and natural systems too.
Well, given that overview, it seems like it would have taken project members about 6 seconds to realize the opportunity and research that the shelter-in-place orders presented.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, first of all, hearts go out to all the people who are, have lost their jobs and loved ones even. But amidst the tragedy, it was this incredible experiment. It's the kind of thing you can't do. Ask people to stay home and look at the effect on the air. Maybe the closest thing to it in this country was the blackout 20 or so years ago, perhaps back to the 90s in the Northeast.
Mm-hmm.
Where all of a sudden the coal plants shut down and the sky cleared up. So that's what we saw around the world. I mean, there are short-term pollutants, nitrogen and sulfur, that dropped within days 40 or 50%. And people just noticed how clean the air was. My son called me from L.A. and said, the skies are blue here. And we also look at carbon dioxide and greenhouse gas emissions, which don't change so quickly. And that was really the focus of our study.
I noticed that your son had called you and said, the sky's clear in L.A. It's still a remarkable thing, even after all these years of pollution controls.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, it wasn't just L.A. From Mumbai to Milan to all over the world. I think it shows people, reminds us what things could be like. And we don't want to have clean air and reduce greenhouse gas emissions because people are forced to stay at home and the economy's in free fall. We want to reap those benefits while people can still go about a normal life and work properly and such. So we could combine that though by things like electric vehicles and clean energy, hydro in the Northeast as an example. I mean, in the Northwest as an example. And we could have blue skies like that every day without staying at home, just by coupling clean vehicles and clean energy in our cities. So there are opportunities, I think, for us to put into play changes more permanently.
Okay, a chance to look ahead there for sure. But let's look back at what you did in measuring. I mean, were there any guesses about how far the CO2 emissions would drop over the course of the confinement period?
We really didn't know. So I'll maybe give you a quick overview of what we did and kind of why. We were bombarded with questions all the way back to February, really, about what the virus would do to industrial emissions and transportation vehicles. Cars, light vehicles were the biggest change, obviously. I was struck by how poorly prepared we were to track really short-term effects. The way weather people track day-to-day changes. We tend to work more on monthly scales and annual budgets.
Mm-hmm.
So we really
so
had
not
to scramble.
Like daily precipitation, daily temperature, that kind of stuff that weather
exactly.
people do.
Exactly. I mean, there's no daily carbon dioxide emissions that you get, by opening the newspaper or something or checking online. So, we had to do a couple of things. We first used a confinement index. As you can imagine, a map of the world, confinement began in China. It sort of spread to Europe and then to the U.S. So there's a mosaic of timing, if you will, of countries and people who are, staying at home in one place but not yet in another. And by the time the virus has really shut down our economy here in the U.S., China was already opening back up. So we mapped the number of people around the world who were in confinement and then in sort of what their typical emissions were for carbon dioxide. Then on top of that, we overlaid different estimates of economic activity. You know, transportation contributed the most to the decline, about 40%. But we used everything from road sensors to document the decline in the vehicle numbers, bridge traffic, retail gasoline sales around the world to some extent, although those are hard to get. We looked at aviation, power production, steel production, and things like that. So we were able to combine changes in activity with confinement to make our estimates of how much emissions dropped.
Wow, so you bring in a lot of different numbers then.
We did, and I should acknowledge my my colleagues. The paper was led by a woman named Corinne Le Carré in the UK, and about a dozen of us or so who contributed to this particular study. So a lot of work, and very, very quickly. It was like a late night college cramming session that lasted a month or so.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing because the publication in Nature Climate Change of the technical research paper was on May 19th, signed simultaneously with a Scientific American publication the same day. We're talking to Rob Jackson, a professor of Earth System Science at Stanford University, senior fellow at the Stanford Woods Institute for the Environment, and leader of the Global Carbon Project, about measuring just how much CO2 emissions dropped during the confinement of people from the coronavirus around the world. Join the conversation on the exchange. Questions, comments, welcome at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So did you come up, Rob, with a daily average drop or an overall drop for a month or something? And what were the numbers you expressed here?
Yeah, we did, and it kind of depends on the time scale and such. But, on average, we found that around the world, for a global number, emissions dropped in, say, the first half of April, about 1/6. 17% was the number we estimated. For countries, though, the drops were steeper because that global peak drop combines different places and different levels of lockdown. Here in the U.S., our emissions dropped a third for about a 10-day period in April. I mean, that's an astounding change. Primarily because of transportation, about half of that drop came from cars and air traffic, but it also arose from declines in production, industrial activity, which we don't want in terms of the economy. Electricity, commercial buildings were empty. Overall, it was about a third at peak for the U.S. And globally, for the year, we estimated about a 4-7% decline. And that may not sound like very much, but that would be the biggest drop since World War II and probably ever. And it could be even bigger than that this year.
All right, but 4-7% for the year, as you say, is significant. But does that make a dent in the overall level of atmospheric carbon? I mean, is the parts per billion changing at all?
Well, the parts per million would still go up because, of course, it's not that we've stopped emissions. They're just, instead of 37 billion tons a year, they might be 33 or 35 billion tons.
So the lower rate,
you think of the atmosphere as a bathtub. The spigot is still on. We've just kind of shut off the spigot a little bit. So concentrations will definitely go up this year. But it's not to belittle a change like that. The real question is, how can we put in place permanent changes? What can we learn about the clean air, about telecommuting, and the working from home, people looking around thinking, gosh, I'm not sure I want to commute an hour a day into work. Companies, Facebook just announced that they were going to let a lot of their employees work from home permanently. So those kinds of changes, cities rethinking roads. Seattle has not just closed off roads to cars and opened them to bikes and pedestrians temporarily, but they're making some of those changes permanent. And those kinds of things are happening around the world. And I've already mentioned the need for changes in mobility, electric vehicles, clean electricity, and things like that. So, making these changes permanent is the only way they'll be real and substantive long term.
All right. Well, this gets back to the reality of the society we're dealing with now. I mean, the numbers can't stay this low, I'm thinking. I mean, if the economy comes roaring back, but again, we can doubt that with unemployment heading for 20%. Are we basically getting back to where we were?
In previous crises, the answer would be yes. I mean, if you look at the financial crisis of 10 years ago, which was also a real economic downturn here in the U.S., global emissions dropped about 1.5% for 1 year, And in 2010, they roared back 5% as if nothing had changed. I think this time will be different. The decline economically is more severe. You know, it's not clear that the virus is going away anytime soon, at least in terms of a vaccine. But we can't rely on economic crises to fix the climate problem. They don't tend to make permanent reductions. So I think, again, the real important piece of this discussion is how stimulus funding can be, you know, targeted to the clean energy transition. You know, you look at going back to 2009, 2010 stimulus funding again. You know, we invested $50 billion in wind and solar production, and that investment was one of the best economic returns. So the country got the most back for its money. But it also put in place things that we're benefiting from today, record low wholesale wind and solar pricing in the electricity sector. And we need that kind of thinking, clean energy thinking, mobility thinking, transportation thinking in this stimulus funding. You know, right now in the HEROES Act that's in the Senate, there isn't really anything in there about clean electricity, investment tax, or production credits. So I think it's the stimulus funding. We need to put people back to work, and that's job number one for the country. But the funds need to be allocated to things that will help us with the clean energy transition.
Have you had any contact with members of Congress to suggest such things?
Yeah, more with staffers. I don't, I'm not somebody with a Congress people and senators call me up every day and ask how I'm doing. But I do, I do talk a lot to staffers on a regular basis, and I do talk to people in Congress occasionally too, and not just in the U.S. outside the U.S. in other countries. So lots of people, lots of lobbyists and such are, everybody's scrambling to get a piece of this pie. But there are thoughtful people, thinking about how we can take this tragic occurrence and at least learn something from it and apply it to long-lasting benefit for the country.
You mentioned, Rob Jackson, using the confinement index. Is it pretty much a straight shot, a straight connection, greater confinement equals greater reduction?
Yeah, it is. We used a three-tiered confinement index, and the lowest tier, zero would be no confinement at all. Tier one would be the first step, like we shut off international flights from China and such early on. So curtailing international travel would be an example of a first step in tier one. Tier three at the top is when we're in shelter at home conditions and such as we were, some of us still are around the country.
So is transportation usually the greatest contributor to carbon in the atmosphere?
No, transportation contributes about a fifth, a quarter of global emissions. The electricity sector contributes the most carbon dioxide emissions around the world. So that's coal, natural gas primarily. Coal use is ticking downwards a little bit globally, rapidly in the U.S. and Europe. Mm-hmm. Another probably 20% drop in coal use this year in the U.S. is projected. Other places it's still going up a bit. Industry is about another quarter. And then the stragglers, 4-5% in things like commercial buildings and aviation and other areas.
Given that so many people were not working at their workplaces, would you have thought there would have been a greater reduction in electricity consumption because of the fact that industrial sites weren't using all their electricity?
Yeah, so there are really three buckets to think about the electricity use. There's home use, and of course that didn't go down at all because we were home even more than we would have been normally. Commercial building use and retail space and such did go down. And then there's electricity that goes into manufacturing and industrial activity. And that dropped for a different reason, not because people weren't using buildings necessarily, but because of less demand for goods and services. So the second and third things, commercial space, manufacturing decreased, home use of electricity ticked up a little bit, as would be expected.
Yeah, I was surprised that it didn't really take off. And I guess the assumption that I made here was that we might be able to go a little further in not heating and cooling our homes when we're not actually in them.
Yeah, it is interesting that home use did go up a little bit, but not a lot. I think it's partly because the big users of electricity in our homes are people who have electric furnaces, obviously air conditioning for in the warmer parts of the of the U.S. in particular. But you know, things like lighting and such, you know, definitely make a difference, and conservation is important. But you know, we were still using most of the electricity in our homes, even when we're off somewhere else working or doing other things. So it really didn't change that much.
All right, so it sounds like transportation, again, is the thing you come back to about more electric vehicles or more electric generation that doesn't involve fossil fuels.
Yeah, I highlight transportation for a couple of reasons. The virus and shelter-at-home rules, you know, changed the transportation instantly. I mean, and you had, you know, families bicycling on busy roads at rush hour, and you know, the lack of traffic jams and such. But transportation has been the hardest part of the economy to decarbonize. Right? We have made tremendous progress in the electricity sector, great progress through energy efficiency. But boy, cars are not that different today. They are more fuel efficient, and the proposed rollback of fuel efficiency standards in the U.S. is a disaster for both economic and environmental reasons, but that's the subject for a different show.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, transportation has been tough to decarbonize, so we need to encourage personal mobility, walking, biking, even scooters and things for people in urban areas. So we don't want to promote cars, but we do need to switch from gas-powered cars to electric vehicles powered by clean energy. And you know, cars and coal still kill 100,000 Americans a year from air pollution, and a million or a couple million people worldwide. I mean, these things, we know that they affect us, and so every year we're losing 50 or 100,000 people to pollution from cars and coal. It doesn't have to be that way.
Do you see potential health benefits from the reduction in emissions this time? Might fewer people die this year because of respiratory issues caused by inhaling the products of power plants, et cetera?
Well, in a narrow sense, yes. And I'm not in any way suggesting that the virus is a good thing. It's not.
Right.
But there are benefits. Less childhood asthma. I mean, hospital visits are strongly correlated with air pollution, you know, cardiopulmonary disease. So yes, I would expect it may be a hard thing to show. We're going to see a huge drop, and we've already seen a huge drop in things like asthma visits and heart attacks and such. It's going to be very hard to attribute cause to that, right? Because nobody wants to go to the doctor or the hospital. So you know, that drop isn't just because of potentially from cleaner air. It's because people are choosing to stay home, frankly.
Mm-hmm. All right, so a 17% drop around the world in CO2 emissions, about a third in the USA for a brief period in early April, as tracked by the people at the Global Carbon Project. You can see the article at Nature Climate Change. Temporary reduction in daily global CO2 emissions during the COVID-19 forced confinement. In Scientific American, same date, May 19th, COVID-19 could permanently transform transportation, as you heard from Rob Jackson, who leads the Global Carbon Project from Stanford University. Thank you so much for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange today.
Thank you, Jeff. Take care.
All right, you too.